From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. As we find ourselves surrounded by political convention coverage, we thought it would be a good idea to get an alternative view of our political system, a view we don't often hear represented in mainstream media. My guest this hour is Iowa native and former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson. He served under three presidents in Washington before returning to Iowa. His new book, Are We There Yet?, offers reflections on politics in America, such as, how different are the two major parties really? We'll explore that question and others with Nicholas Johnson after this news. And this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What experience is most relevant in a future president? Do new technologies threaten or strengthen our democracy? Should political contributions be protected as speech? These are just a few of the questions we'll be discussing this hour. My guest is native Iowan and former Federal Communications Commission Commissioner Nicholas Johnson. In the 1960s and 70s, he served under three presidents in Washington, Johnson, Nixon, and Carter, before returning to Iowa in 1980. He is best known for his controversial term as a dissenting FCC commissioner from 1966 to 1973, and for his book, How to Talk Back to Your Television. In 1971, in fact, he appeared on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. In 1974, he ran for Congress from Iowa's 3rd District. Since returning to Iowa in 1980, he's been on the faculty of the University of Iowa College of Law. His teaching emphasis is on communications and internet law. And his new book is titled, Are We There Yet? Reflections on Politics in America. Nicholas Johnson joins me in the studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Ben.
We'd like to get your views this hour on what you think is wrong with our political system and then find out from you your views on how you think it might be improved. Let's make sure, for those who don't know Nicholas Johnson, haven't heard him speak in the many years you've been around the state, people know where you're coming from. How would you describe your party affiliation?
Well, I'm kind of like Mike Huckabee on the other side of the fence. He was asked whether he was truly a conservative, and he assured the questioner, oh, I'm a conservative, all right. I'm just not angry about it. I've been all my presidential appointments have come from presidents who were Democrats. When I ran for Congress and before that for U.S. Senate briefly, I ran as a Democrat. When I've been precinct captain or chair of the Johnson County Democratic Convention, I've been a Democrat. But particularly with the blogging, I'm open to meeting and hearing from when they've been here this past year. I met with Newt Gingrich. I met with Karl Rove. Met with Mike Huckabee. I wrote a very positive blog entry about Mike Huckabee, even though I disagree with him on virtually every single issue. But I think he's been very decent in a variety of ways. When Bush first proposed No Child Left Behind, which subsequently became sort of a disaster, but the initial idea, I wrote a favorable op-ed column in the Press Citizen. So I like to believe that I try to be fair and interested in whatever anybody has to say. I think many people who read the blog because of my opposition to using government money, taxpayers' money, and putting it onto the bottom line of for-profit corporations assume I must be a libertarian. So I suppose there's a little bit of that in there too.
And your work is not without criticism for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I'm kind of fed up with both parties if you want to know the truth. And we may get to that later in terms of the money issue, but their service of the very largest corporations and wealthiest Americans.
We'll talk about that certainly later in the hour as well. Let's start with your book title, Are We There Yet? Where or what is the there? Where is our destination? What are you getting at in this book?
Well, as I begin the first page, the overview, surely anyone who has ever taken young children on a cross-country trip has had to answer that question a great many times before ever getting there. It was also a question many political activists were asking themselves as they traveled the long road along the presidential primary of 2007 and 2008. But it's a question that can also be asked about America's two centuries-long journey along the road from the Declaration of Independence, Constitution, and its Bill of Rights to the day when we can honestly proclaim that the promise of those documents has been realized. So it's, are we there yet in a number of senses?
My feeling is your answer to that is no, we're not there yet, and we'll find out in what ways we're not
well,
there yet.
Well, as Lawrence Ferlinghetti once wrote, I am still waiting for someone to really discover America.
Okay. Late last week, the McCain campaign surprised everyone with the selection of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin to be John McCain's running mate. Her experience has been put in the spotlight. You write about experience in this book. What experience is most relevant for a future president? How should we perceive the spin from both camps? Because the Republicans and the Democrats are both maintaining their candidates have the needed experience. What is your framework for looking at that word?
Well, let me begin by making, I think, a very important point, which is that I think someone can have virtually no experience whatsoever and still end up being qualified to be president based on their record in office. And I think others can have the kind of experience that I would call for and think relevant to the presidency and end up being a total disaster. From my perspective, having been around the White House a bit, I think that there are a number of things that could be helpful to a president that I describe as a breadth of experience. First of all, experience at administering a very large institution, which the United States government is. And that could be experience with a federal cabinet level department, a state government as governor, a large military branch, a major university. There are a lot of places where you can get that kind of administrative experience.
You left out U.S. Senator as one of those areas.
Well, I leave that out because the other area of experience that I think is relevant is what I call a breadth of experience, and that would include legislative experience. But it creates both the rapport with the individuals the president needs to work with and also a substantive understanding of what they are doing. And I would include within those groups city, county, and state government that is impacted by the federal government, the federal executive branch, the legislative branch, which would include the Senate, the judicial branch, the administrative branches, but also international organizations, United Nations, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, embassies, and of lots of major constituent groups, but among them trade unions on the one hand and the Wall Street financial community on the other. And I would say, since you ask about senators, that in terms of the breadth of experience, a United States senator who's primarily or only been a United States senator does not have that breadth of experience. They've got what I call stovepipe experience. The 30 years they've been there may not be 30 years experience. It may be 1 year's experience 30 times. So that by that standard, in an odd sort of way, Governor Palin, who's served as a mayor of a small town, admittedly, and as governor for admittedly a short term, at least has had experience with community with city and state government. Barack Obama, who's had about 12 years of legislative experience, McCain 25. I'm not sure that makes McCain twice as qualified to be president as Barack Obama. Indeed, Barack Obama had experience with a state legislature, so mm-hmm. He has some perspective of what the impact of federal government is on state.
Would it count to his experience working in Chicago for the community? That experience is in what category?
Well, I think it's what I call life experience, and I think there are all kinds of things. I think that the boards and public interest organization boards of directors that Hillary Clinton served on is of that nature. I think that's helpful. His work as community organizer is very helpful for another reason that we may or may not get into. But the senators, Clinton, Obama, now Biden as vice president, McCain, none of them has served as a mayor or a governor. None has headed a cabinet-level department. None has helped administer the Pentagon or the CIA. None has worked for international organizations, been an ambassador to the United Nations. None has been an ambassador to a foreign country. None has headed delegations negotiating with foreign governments over trade agreements or release of hostages or treaties. Now, compare that with the experience that the president's father had as ambassador to China, head of the CIA, former member of the House. Compare it with the experience of Governor Bill Richardson. 15 years legislative experience in the U.S. House and an understanding of state government from two terms as governor and of federal government from the Department of Energy, where he was secretary of a major federal department with an enormous budget, the significant administrative experience as governor and a cabinet secretary, and the international perspective of a former ambassador to the United Nations, along with international accomplishments beyond that, including successful hostage negotiations with Saddam Hussein and others, that inspired some five Nobel Peace Prize nominations. So that's the kind of breadth of experience that I think might be relevant. But I repeat, I think somebody I think that all the senators I just mentioned are perfectly qualified to be president. But they wouldn't. I think it's silly for. It was silly for Senator Clinton to try to base a case for voting for her on the grounds that she had more experience than the others.
We have to take a short break. My guest this hour on The Exchange, former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, and he's been teaching at the University of Iowa College of Law for many years now. His reflections on politics in America are captured in a new book titled Are We There Yet? And what are your reflections on politics in America? We'd like to find out. Include your questions and comments. What should we be looking for in a future president? How do you define relevant experience for the job of president? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Curious, interesting fact about Nicholas Johnson. He was once on the cover of Rolling Stone, 1971. Rolling Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone. Wanna buy five copies for my mother. Yes. Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone. My guest this hour is Nicholas Johnson, Iowa native, also best known for his controversial term as a dissenting FCC commissioner from 1966 to 1973, served under three presidents in Washington before returning to Iowa in 1980, and teaches now at the University of Iowa College of Law. His new book is titled, Are We There Yet? Reflections on Politics and America. We'd like to have your reflections as well. What do you hear that you agree with or disagree with? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Nicholas Johnson, one of the big themes in this book is money, how it drives this country's politics. What do you see as the major problems money and politics create when they come together like this?
Well, the problem they create is that unless the major parties are going to give their major contributors a poke in the eye with a sharp stick, they are only decently only decent for them to respond to these campaign
contributions. So there is a quid pro quo undoubtedly with these contributions.
Absolutely. And I did, one of the chapters in the book is a piece I did some years ago for the Des Moines Register. It's one of the few that I've where I've included the the footnotes that exist on the webpage, but not, of course, in the op-ed column itself, in which I document that as a rough rule of thumb, once you are contributing in the $100,000 to $1 million category, the payback is something between 1,000 to 1 and 2,000 to 1.
How did you measure that?
Well, I started off with the milk producers, interestingly enough, who wanted to have an increase in the support price of milk. And the Department of Agriculture explained politely that they viewed themselves as the advocates for the farmers, but they really just could not justify an additional increase in the support price of milk. Not long after, Richard Nixon received $200,000 in cash from the milk producers. And shortly after that, the support price of milk was increased by $400 million to the American consumers. And I thought, my golly, that's kind of odd. And I didn't major in math, but it didn't take me long to divide $400 million by $200,000 and conclude, my golly, those folks got back $2,000 for every dollar they gave. You can't do anything close to that well on the stock exchange. So I started looking at other industries and laid out a lot of what was going on at that time. And what are we talking about? What kind of paybacks do you get? What categories? Well, they're tax breaks, they're defense contracts and other kinds of contracts, they're tariffs, they're price supports like the milk case, they're subsidies, they're bailouts. We see those by the billions of dollars for various industries and companies. They're earmarks like the $50 million for the Iowa rainforest. They're the creation of specifications that have to be met when only your company can meet those specifications.
But just because it's for a certain company, it benefits one a certain company, doesn't mean it's not also in the public interest, right?
Well, wrong. When you're talking about – one of the things you're talking about is a failure to enforce the antitrust laws or a willingness to sit back and let prices go up. Why do we pay what we pay for pharmaceutical products? Why is our government precluded by our Congress from negotiating with these companies over price? Why are we forbidden to import from other countries as other countries are
Canada.
Permitted to? Yeah.
Canada, for instance. And
oil prices. The point, that's why the headline on the piece was, you pay $4 or you pay $4,000. If you're going to give them a 1,000-to-1 payback, it means you as a taxpayer or a consumer are going to pay that extra $3,996 because your car costs more, your gas costs more, your pharmaceutical products cost more, your food in the grocery store costs more. That's how you are paid. So I say all campaigns are publicly financed. It's either you pay as a taxpayer through a checkoff system or the money that Barack Obama refused to accept so he could raise more privately, or you're going to pay in the prices you pay in the marketplace and the taxes you pay that get transferred over to wealthy corporations.
So for you, the fact that the Obama campaign will not be taking public money and John McCain will has no significance.
Oh, no, it does have significance. I would far prefer to have public financing of campaigns in the straightforward way where I pay $4 towards the presidential campaign instead of having to pay $4,000.
Mm-hmm. In financing of campaigns, we have a couple minutes before we have to take another break, but how do we fix it? What would be a better system that would also be politically feasible to implement?
Well, for starters, since we're on radio, and radio and television are licensed to serve the public interest, one of the longstanding proposals that's never been adopted is that one of the requirements would be that free time would be made available to candidates and for campaigns. Because as I discovered when running for Senate and Congress here from Iowa, you take care of the radio and television costs of campaigning, And you've eliminated the problem of campaign finance because it represents as much as 90% of what people are raising this money for.
But how do you decide who is eligible for that amount of time and how much time? You would have to pick only major candidates?
No. Now you're getting into administrative details I'm not sure you want to pursue during the course of an hour-long discussion. But there are answers to all those questions. As for who would get it, it would be similar to who now gets equal opportunity under the Equal Opportunity Provision of the Communications Act.
Okay. Let's go to our first caller if you'd like to get in your comment or question about reflections on politics in America. What have you been bothered by lately that you'd like to see fixed in our system? 1-866-780-9100. What do you hear from Nicholas Johnson that you agree with or disagree with? 1-866-780-9100. George joins us from Cedar Falls. Good morning, George.
Yes. I always find it ironic when a minority and or woman politician takes a conservative position on something when you think about it, not too long ago, conservative ideology would have kept them out of the game. So now I'm a liberal Democrat, so I'm a little prejudiced, but I think, though, and I'm a white male, so I don't know women or minorities thinking, but it's just from an outside observer seems a little ironic that they seem to be, when they take a conservative position, attacking the ideology that got them into the game in the first place.
Okay, George, very good. Are we there yet? The title of your book, we have presidential candidates, Barack Obama, and female vice president candidate presumed nominee. We have to wait a couple days for that nominee title, sorry. Is that a step along the road of are we there yet? Progress there, of course.
Oh, I think, of course, we'd have to say so, and particularly what Hillary Clinton accomplished with her campaign. It was, after all, very relatively close. So we're going to be making history this year, regardless of which party wins.
Mm-hmm. Any further comment to what George had to say about?
Well, the one thing to comment is that when you are taking big money from major industries and lobbyists and corporations and the top one-tenth of 1% of the wealthiest, you're going to have to trim your sails a little bit under that kind of a system. Now, here is the ABC has had a report on what they call the money trail. They're continuing it this week with the Republicans. They had it last week for the Democratic convention. Here's one of the things they reported. One of the country's leading lobbyists, Steve Farber, was chosen by Howard Dean as chief fundraiser of the Denver Host Committee. This founding partner of Brownstein, Farber and Hyatt, one of the most prominent and active lobbying operations in Washington, persuaded some 141 corporations to contribute more than $50 million towards the Democratic convention. And if you give me a little time later, I want to describe a just incredible contrast between how the wealthy folks in attendance and the regular delegates were treated.
Okay, we'll be back in just a few minutes to talk with Nicholas Johnson, former FCC commissioner, native Iowan, has served under three presidents, has a new book out. It's titled, Are We There Yet? Reflections on Politics in America. Please do join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll address Nicholas Johnson was speaking of. Also, do new technologies threaten or strengthen our democracy? That question put to Nicholas Johnson as well. We'll be back with more of The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio in just a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest is native Iowan and former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson. He served under three presidents in the 60s and 70s. Since 1980, he's been teaching at the University of Iowa College of Law, known for his term as an FCC commissioner, but also for his book, How to Talk Back to Your Television. Appeared on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine in 1971. Maybe we'll get to talk about the circumstances of that if toward the end of the program. His new book, Are We There Yet? Reflections on Politics in America. And we have a number of callers waiting to talk to you, Nicholas Johnson, 1-866-780-9100. Let's pick up with the point that we left off with. You wanted to make a point about an observation you made at the Democratic National Convention and how that ties in with the role that money plays in our politics.
Right. ABC has been doing a series on the Democratic Convention last week, Republicans this week. That is a very insightful portrayal of how Washington really works, much more so than what's going on the floor of the convention. Special privileges for those who give $100,000 and more included a Denver Performing Arts penthouse show with Tony Bennett and James Taylor, preferred booking at top hotels, and I quote three sentences from their report one evening. Last night, the wealthy donors in the skybox watched as Senator Hillary Clinton praised Barack Obama for knowing, quote, the government must be about we the people, not we the favored few. ABC continues, the favored few in the Democratic Finance Committee skybox were treated to an open bar and food in silver chafing dishes. Delegates outside the closed curtain of the skybox stood in line for $7 hot dogs and were not permitted to bring food to their seats at the Pepsi Center. It nicely dramatizes, I think, who's really running politics in this country, which means who's really running government. When you see these senators and congressmen sitting down with major lobbyists.
So both parties are in the same boat when it comes to keeping the status quo in terms of money's role in maintaining power.
That's the way I see it. I mean, you know, somebody can argue with me and I'll listen, but... you know, it was George Wallace who said there's not a dime's worth of difference between the parties back in 1968 when he was running. I think that's wrong. Obviously, there's a dime's worth of difference. And for starters, they're both very big tent parties, and so they've got a variety of points of view within each party. But when it comes to the interests of major corporations, major industries, and the top one-tenth of 1% of the wealthiest people in the country, I don't see much difference between the two major parties, and I think we will not see it on the ABC series last week and this week.
Mm-hmm. So quickly before we go to calls, the way to change that, it would have to take a grassroots movement because your elected politicians are all benefiting from this.
Well, and that's what I find many things attractive about all the candidates and all the parties. But one of the things I found most attractive about Barack Obama was one of the first things he and I talked about over a year ago, and that is his background in community organizing. Because I think a part of what I see as a potential with him is precisely that. Is a using these nearly 1.5 million contributors, tens of millions of supporters, 80,000 people in Denver Stadium, et cetera, all across the country, keeping in touch with them. That's part of what the text messaging, to tie into your technology question, of the selection of Joe Biden was about, that to use those folks to respond to the anecdote often told about Franklin Roosevelt, who, when invaded upon by someone with a program for legislation that he supported, he would say, I agree with you absolutely. Now you go out there and make me do it. And I think, meaning right. That when the people will lead, their leaders will follow. And what Barack Obama's in a position to do is to help organize, to become, in effect, the community organizing commander-in-chief for the nation and build the kind of grassroots base of support to bring about the kinds of changes that he's been talking about, changes that no president can do by himself or herself.
Let's go to our phones. Several people want to talk to you. 1-866-780-9100. Bob is on the line from Bettendorf to talk to Nicholas Johnson. Good morning, Bob.
Hello. Our founding fathers more or less believed that politicians would be doing favors for their friends. You read about this in the Federalist Papers. And therefore, one of the ideas was to limit the damage by having limited government and having a more or less laissez-faire economy. What do you think about that concept?
Well, I think that's an interesting concept, and I have a colleague who believes in a divided government. He doesn't care so much which party's in the White House and which controls the Congress. He just wants to make sure it's two different parties. We have a great deal of provisions in the Constitution that are designed to assure that government's not going to get very much done because there's always somebody to check it one way or another.
Okay, thank you, Bob from Bettendorf.
Thank you.
There's an email. Larry in Cedar Falls says, George W. Bush had the experience, in quotation marks, to which Professor Johnson has referred, but his presidency, by most measures, has been a failure. I think intellectual depth and breadth are more relevant criteria by which to assess candidates for public office, including the presidency, writes Larry in Cedar Falls.
Well, I've already said that I thought there's a great deal to be said for Larry's point, that not only did George Bush have experience, at least as governor, but Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney had a wide variety of experience, including having served before as Secretary of Defense, having served before as Chief of Staff for a president in the White House, having served in the Congress, etc. So I made the point early on that the mere existence of experience doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a qualified and proficient president. And the absence of experience doesn't mean that you're not going to get a good one. And I would agree with Larry that we're looking for, or I am, for what I would call a judicial mind, somebody who's capable of holding things in balance rather than knee-jerk ideological responses, somebody who's basically honest, somebody who likes people. You know, there are a lot of qualities that I think, and obviously intelligence, knowledge. Something close to the president we had in the television series The West Wing, which I assume a lot of people would have voted for, are things that make a lot of difference, ethics, et cetera.
Let's go to Iowa City. Shirley is in Iowa City joining our conversation. Good morning.
Good morning. My husband likes to say that we have the best government that money can buy. And I think that's pretty evident that doesn't actually buy us a very great government sometimes. And my question is, first of all, is it possible to sever those money ties to big business? Obviously, corporations have a great deal to say about decisions that are made in Washington. And ancillary to that, I would say, I think part of it has been set up because of the Supreme Court judgment sometime in the late 19th century that allowed corporations to be viewed as individual entities.
Yes, I would agree with you about that. George Burns in Oh God had the line that the one thing he'd messed up was the avocado because the seed was too big, and I think we may have done the same thing with that clerk's interpretation of a Supreme Court decision back in the 19th century. But I hate to use a word like fascism because it's so emotionally loaded that it sounds like you're drawing conclusions from it. But the definition is the intertwining of corporate interests with government interests, where you have a government-corporate symbiotic institution, essentially, that is running things. And I think that's very close to what we have, and that doesn't mean we have the other awful qualities of a fascist regime. I think I'll stop that sentence there. I was going to go on and say something else. But that is the characteristic of what we have.
Thank you, Shirley, calling from Iowa City. Andy in Iowa City has an email question. What can be done to encourage and develop the growth of third parties in this country? The Green Party, for example, offers policy alternatives which speak to me more than those of either of the two major parties. However, in a close race, Andy points out, there is the dilemma of whether a vote for the Greens might mean a win for the Republicans. What are your reflections on the role of third parties, Nicholas Johnson?
Well, for starters, I think virtually all of the progressive social legislation we've had in this country has come as a result of third-party pressure. Social Security, child labor laws, minimum wages, maximum hours, safety in the workplace, at least proposals for meaningful universal single-payer health care, starting actually before Truman, but most especially with Harry Truman. So I think third parties have a very important role to play, and that we're really kind of shooting ourselves in the foot as a nation as a result of giving all the power to make the decisions to the Democrats and the Republicans, for example, with the presidential debates. An awful lot turns on who you put in those presidential debates. And if you keep a candidate out, that candidate probably is not going to get a lot of votes. They're not going to have the credibility that comes from that. And that's one of the issues that I address in the book, Are We There Yet? That what we could do, all the ways in which third parties are prevented. And actually, there are many proposals for reforming the system that would actually benefit the major parties too. But they're just too stubborn on this thing to give anything up. So it's a tough struggle. As for what the voter should do, what late friend of mine Molly Ivins once proposed is that if you're in a state that's close, vote Democratic. But if you're in a state that is either clearly going to go for the Republican or go for the Democrat, that gives you a lot more freedom to vote for a third party and at least register it as a protest vote.
You write also about spin in your book. So much of what we hear is spin from the campaigns. How is a typical voter busy with a job during the day, cannot, you know, read reams of political commentary and see between the lines? How is a typical voter to understand spin and recognize spin that may not be very close to the truth, actually, be a selective truth?
Well, I think since the media is taking money from the campaigns to put these commercials on the air, I think they also have the responsibility, and indeed some exercise it, to do a kind of truth squad evaluation of the commercials. And I've raised recently a question of whether we need to revisit New York Times v. Sullivan, which gives the media kind of a base on balls when they're involved in repeating information that is essentially defamatory if the person who would be the plaintiff is also a public official. Because I think we've got some awful stuff out there. And yesterday or today, Barack Obama said with regard to the daughter of the governor of Alaska that anything having to do with the families really ought to be off the, you know, table, and that nobody in his campaign had anything to do with the stories that were being reported, and that if he ever found out that any did, that they would be immediately fired and so forth. I mean, I think we need to have more of that kind of response from the candidates. Mm.
You, your blog, for those who want to follow your writings, we want to mention, is From D.C. to Iowa, D.C., the letters, and then the numeral 2, to iowa.blogspot.com. Or probably Googling Nicholas Johnson will get you there, too.
Or the webpage, www.nicholasjohnson, all one word, N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S, and the usual spelling of Johnson, .org. And I chose ORG instead of com because I do virtually nothing that's com. So I decided okay, I should be an org. But there's a link off of the webpage to the blog, an index for the blog, and lots of other stuff.
I mentioned that not just to plug your website to get people in contact with you, but also to point out that you are very connected with new technologies, using them to spread your ideas, let people know what you're thinking. Do technologies threaten or strengthen our democracy?
Both. I think that and we're discussing that actually this afternoon in Law of Electronic Media at the law school. I think that one of the things that happens, Friedman put it in his book, The World is Flat, that as so many people are interconnected via the internet, that information can spread so fast gossip of all kinds, mean-spirited stuff, deliberate lies. That clearly is not helping. And on the other hand, what is there's a wonderful kind of relationship growing up between the media. You mentioned my book from the 70s, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, and what made the title cute was that it was preposterous. I mean, you couldn't possibly talk back to your television set. It was a one-way, from one to the many communication system. And the extent now to which, say, local papers here have an online presence that permits readers of the newspaper story to put their comment about the story on the newspaper's webpage.
For all to see.
For all to see. They have forums. They have local citizens who are not employees who have their own blogs. So that's a big change in the media. And clearly, Barack Obama would not be where he is, and he learned a lot from Howard Dean and took it to the next level without the kind of internet communities that the new technology makes possible.
You write also in this book that the media misled the public about the Democratic Party primary's significance. That would be a surprise for many to hear. How so?
Well, I think when they I don't know whether it's that they don't understand the Iowa caucus system and the primary system, or whether they just don't have much respect for the audience and think the audience couldn't ever understand it. But they talk about who won a primary when there's proportional distribution of the delegates.
When it's 6 percentage points difference, then you can't call that a clear win?
No. I mean, it's a win. It will be a win in November. Whoever gets more than 50% of the vote, or whoever gets the most votes in any given state, and will get all the electoral delegates from that state, all right, in the Electoral College. So that's a case where whoever gets the most votes, one can legitimately say they won that state. They got everything from that state, even though they didn't get all the votes.
Mm.
But when you divide up the delegates to a convention proportionately based on what proportion of the votes you got, I think it's misleading to suggest that one person won and the other person lost. Indeed, with Texas, which the media said Hillary Clinton won, Obama ended up with more delegates from Texas than Hillary Clinton did. And yet she was proclaimed to have beaten him in Texas.
Mm. Let's jump to one of the other major themes in your book here, too, as we wind up this conversation, about 4 minutes left. How is war, terrorism, and fear, as you say, used as campaign strategy?
Well, when people are afraid, they tend to vote for incumbents. And the question is whether the use of fear is manipulated. There's a wonderful quote from Goering, which I'm probably not going to be able to find, but Hitler's advisor, who commented that something along this line, that it works the same in all countries, whether they're communist or fascist or whatever, that if you tell the people that they're being attacked, that they will become fearful and view as disloyal and unpatriotic anybody who doesn't support you. And he says, it doesn't make any difference what country it is. It works the same with all the people. You scare them enough and they're with you.
But you grant also that the concerns about national security in the age of terrorism is a legitimate concern.
That's right, but it can also be utilized in ways that serve political purposes. You've seen the movie Wag the Dog, I presume.
Yes.
Well, starting a war is a pretty nifty way to get the focus off of other problems.
Let's go to our last caller, Darren, I think, is still in Davenport waiting. Hi, Darren.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. We don't have too much time, though, Darren. Please make it brief.
Okay, let me bust right into it. I was just thinking along the lines of Mr. Johnson when you about your book about Are We There Yet? When we were in this primary, how the media all throws us to the point where they tried to explain New Hampshire's primary about the fact that they had Barack Obama leading by double digits, and then in the fact when it came out to it, he actually lost, so or had a poor showing. So there was the media quickly jumps to it. That's the black vote or the black issue, meaning that people, the white voters, that would get ready to come and on the exit polls would say, or the pre-polls would say, you know what, I'm going to vote for Barack Obama, but when it actually got down to it, the vote wasn't there yet.
Mm.
So therefore, now we all know that that was a would have been a misleading truth, but it boils down to the general election. Is that still the same problem, or have you saw that as just a media's leadoff towards confusion?
Well, I would have to say with regard to Iowa, I don't think Barack Obama won with the African-American vote. Yeah. And one of the ways in which the media can adversely impact a general election is when the reports of the closed polls on the East Coast are put out over the air and they are listened to by people in California who may decide, well, there's no point in voting. But also what you indicated, predicting the outcome of a primary may cause people to stay away. And there comes the music.
Darren, I'm sorry. Thank you for your call. Yeah. Not much time to talk about your very interesting point. Thank you, though. Darren from Davenport for joining our conversation. Nicholas Johnson, we'll have to have you back soon. We want to have you back soon to discuss your new book. You wanted to have a quick point. We've got just a few seconds.
It's available at Prairie Lights in Iowa City and from Amazon.com.
Thank you very much. Nicholas Johnson, The Exchange, produced today by Jeff Schmidt, our producer assistant, Scott Grattan, and theme music composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks to the callers. Thanks to Nicholas Johnson for all of the discussion this hour. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio.